The Catholics of Oz is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to episode 11 of Catholics of Oz. Catholics of Oz is a show where we discuss faith, culture, and what's been happening from an Aussie perspective. Whether it's synods or science, apostolates and apps, providence or productivity, you can hear it right now on the Catholics of Oz. Hello and welcome to episode 11. My name is Lindsay Sant, the host of the show, and joining me today is Jerry Trapnell. How are you going, Jerry?
Very well. Good to be here.
Yeah, here we are for our 11th episode. And so just remember to like Catholics of Oz on the SQPN Facebook page. You can retweet our episodes on Twitter. Leave us comments, subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast app. We're also on YouTube, so if you subscribe there, don't forget to hit the bell to get notifications. And you can also leave us feedback on these different podcast directories. When you leave us feedback and share us with your friends, it helps to grow us, our community, and to help us to reach more listeners. So, Jerry, shall we get straight into it?
Shall do.
Right, let's start our first topic on Faith Beyond Borders.
Well, I'm actually feeling rather good about this. I think we've all arrived at a very special place, eh?
Oh.
Spiritually, ecumenically.
How do you make somebody love you without affecting free will?
Welcome to my world, son. You come up with an answer to that one, you let me know.
Yes, I had to work very hard to pass Latin and theology.
Oh, quite. Those are, of course, the most important things.
Oh, yeah.
I'd sit this one out, Cap.
I don't see how I can.
These guys come from legend. They're basically gods.
There's only one god, man. And I'm pretty sure he doesn't dress like that.
So, Jared, recently, maybe about 4 or 5 weeks ago, Australia had a federal election. And I'm not going to ask you who you voted for. But
I voted for the Pirate Party.
The Pirate Party, yeah, of course. That's the that's kind of the joke every year, isn't it? There's a Pirate Party. What do they actually stand for? I'm not even sure what their policies are.
Skulls and crossbones.
Yeah, just a place to put your vote if you don't want to vote for anyone else. Yeah, I remember there was a... years and years ago when I was little and my dad took me to, when he went to vote, there was a beer party, and their pitch was simply, they only had one policy, and that was increase the amount of beer that's produced in Australia and sell it worldwide, and the economy will just ride off the back of beer profits. I'm not sure that would have worked very well, but...
We didn't get a chance to find out, did we?
Well, they clearly didn't make it. They didn't even get a seat, so no, unfortunately. Why don't we just quickly, very, very briefly, explain how the electoral system kind of works here in Australia for those who might be from another place that's not here. So, Jerry, what do you understand about how we kind of work here?
All right, so there's upper house and lower house, and that's always confused me. But essentially, the ones that get the most attention is the lower house, the House of Reps, I believe. There's, what is it, 149 available seats.
We'll go with that.
And so to get a majority, you have to get the 76. Or is it 150? No, I think it's 140. Anyway,
you have to get 76 to get a majority.
76 is the magic number.
Yeah, whoever gets 76 is the...
majority leader. And you can also then form government. If you don't quite, and we've had this quite often in the last few elections, if you don't quite hit that magic number, you get other political parties make strategic alliance and sort of get your support across the line that way.
Yeah, so we call that a hung parliament when they don't quite reach the 76. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so this recent election, we basically got two parties, red and blue, just like America.
Except the opposite, isn't it?
Yeah. Generally in the way they sort of, in this left and right leaning sort of, the way they would call politics, our left leaning is red and our more right leaning is blue. And so all the exit polls and everything else pointed to a red victory, possibly in the realm of 80 plus seats. And when the votes were counted, we then ended up with a blue Liberal Party, funnily enough. Again, the names as well.
Yeah.
The Liberal Party is the more conservative party in Australia.
It's very interesting how it works, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't think they've finally finalised counting. Liberal Party ended up with a majority. I'm not certain how many seats, but...
I think it was 77 or 78 in the end.
There were a couple clear of the post, which was... possibly echoes of an election in America 3 years ago where no one gave them a chance. And so that's the lay of the land now. Status quo for us. So we've had Liberal in the last one or two elections, and yes. Now that's set to continue for at least another 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, so it's interesting that because you were talking about the polls, like the polling, in fact, not just in the recent polling, but polling for over a year, possibly even 2 years, showed that we're expecting a red victory. I feel so confused trying to get my colours right. But yeah, we ended up having the Liberal Party getting another term, despite the fact that last year the Liberal Party, for the second time in its 2 terms in office, dumped a sitting prime minister and put someone else in its place. And that usually is electoral poison, because that happened with the Labour Party years back as well. And it seems like they managed to survive that one. Do you know off the top of your head how many prime ministers we've had in the last... since 2008 or 2007?
Oh boy, yeah, because before 2007 we had John Howard, who
for a long
probably
time
be quite familiar, because I think he had at least around 4 terms,
yeah,
and then was deposed in 2007. So he was replaced by Kevin Rudd, who was replaced by Julia Gillard, who was replaced by Kevin Rudd, and then that was I think that was the Labour Party's contribution, yeah. And then the Liberals won, I think, with Tony Abbott.
Who was replaced
by Malcolm Turnbull. I don't think Tony Abbott then got back on again.
Nope.
And then after the latest challenge on Malcolm Turnbull, he stepped aside and Scott Morrison, ScoMo, the current Prime Minister, who's now won his own election, is current. I think that makes 6.
Yes.
I don't think I've missed anyone.
No, I think you're about right. So since in all this time with all this turmoil, both parties now have introduced rules in their party where you cannot dump a sitting leader. And it can only be done at an election. So basically after an election, then people can elect to be leader of the party. So I think now we're going to have prime ministers for at least 3 years, I hope, unless there's something else.
Because one of the challenges was if you have 30 consecutive news polls where you're behind or in the red or something, we're going to challenge you.
Yeah, it is.
Which when you think about it and think about how the elections have gone in the last few years, not just here but in America and Britain as well, relying on polls to decide what's actually what the actual feeling of the country is has turned out to be a no-go.
Yeah. What we've learned really is politics hasn't changed around the world. Even in Britain, they're losing their prime minister, and I think Theresa May is stepping down because of the whole Brexit. Anyway, headache. That's probably beyond us. Yeah.
One.
All right. So we'll do a political podcast another day. But why are we talking about the federal election? It's an article was released in the Catholic Weekly, which is a Catholic publication that's produced in New South Wales, by Father Josh Meikles, and his basic discussion point is that in whatever political climate we're in, the laity need to get involved in what's happening in society. So it's titled "Laity Step Up to the Crease." Jared, you want to tell us what the reference there is?
Cricket reference.
Yeah, basically. Yep. So whenever you're batting, you step up to the crease. That's right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Because despite living in a country that loves cricket, I'm not very well versed in the rules of cricket. Some people can watch 3 day tests in
5. I think they go up
5 days. Yeah. I can barely watch, a 2020 match, let alone anything else.
That's supposed to be the exciting one.
That's supposed to be. Yeah. Yeah. Says something about me, doesn't it? So in this article, Father Josh is basically talking about how the election is over now. And in this climate, the laity have a responsibility, he says, because they've been gifted by God to intervene in politics, media, and the public debate. And he says here, he talks about basically how there's this misconception that lay people think that we have to wait for priests to give us our role. You know, we need to, or priests need to do all the work. Priests are the ones who should be intervening and talking in the public square and so on. But he says here that it's kind of patronizing for the laity to think that, it's priests who simply say, what lay people need to hear. He says the laity don't need the bishops to be introduced to the church. They have that already by virtue of their baptism and being created in the image and likeness of God. So, he says priests and pastors already have a role, and that is to work on the spiritual lives of of their flocks, to be a shepherd and so on, and to encourage people to get out there and actually involve themselves in society. So he says where do lay people find their fields of work? And I think we've all heard this a lot, but he says their field of work could be for example where they work, family life, politics, media, the sciences, engineering, the arts, healthcare, the economy, sport, education, public service, caring for the materially and spiritually poor, working with and caring for, where was it? Others, et cetera. I just lost the sense I was reading there. But also people work within, they live with families, they have friends, they've got neighbors, fellow parishioners, they've got work colleagues. So the evangelization field and the discussion of, you know, our involvement in society is right there in front of us. And what he says here is that we need to rely on and be strengthened by Christ. So just a couple of places, things that he says, he says there are countless ways in which we can be involved and have a discussion in society, especially when discussing matters of faith, the morals, etc. But he says here that that there are so many ways that we can do this to catalogue, but here are some of the main ways. Now, the first one, I read it, I had these jarring thoughts, like, oh my goodness, he says, the first one is be political. And sometimes I think, well, I don't want to be political. It's like, have you seen Twitter? who wants to be political? But he says here, now, if you feel so called, you can join a political party. So people can be members of political parties in Australia without actually electing to go into politics, for example. So, but the thing is, there might be a political party, and you know, I'm not really suggesting any political party on this podcast, but you might find a political party that you believe has it right, or has it mostly right, or more right than anyone else. And so you might want to give your support to them. Or maybe it is that there's an interest group. So there are other groups that, how do I put it politely, that pressure political parties as well to change policies and to adopt different policies. So joining some of those groups as well might be a way to do it.
Check if the beer party's still open.
Yeah, let's see. Yeah, they should have a bit of influence there. Yeah. The other thing he says is, discuss things with your local member. So Jared, I used to live in the same electorate as you, and now I'm in the electorate next door. But the electorate of Holtz, I think from memory, we actually have a really good political member there, don't we?
Yeah.
What can you say about him?
Well, he's actually attended parish events where we've had rather large things like our parish priest, I think, what was his 40th anniversary as a priest, and potentially his birthdays as well as things like that. He is quite, has been active in the community. I think he's lasted 20 years.
Yes, he's been that seat for a long time. Yeah. Yep.
And he's owned that seat. Even when the election where, because he's a Labor member, he's red. Although you wouldn't look at it given how he is compared to some of the other members of his party, he seems quite a conservative player, if you like.
Yes.
Yeah, so part of the old school of Labor, which used to be a lot closer aligned, yes, to the centre.
Yeah, there was a time in the Labor Party where there was a kind of a split going on where some members of the Labor Party were worried about the Labor Party. Now we're going back a long way, but sort of getting into bit with communism for a while, so kind of experimenting with that. And then there was the history of BA Santa Maria. Maybe we'll talk about that one day. Trying to form a new Labor Party, which I think is called the Democratic Labor Party now. So it's a very minor party. It's not really a big movement, but that was kind of meant to be the alternative Labor Party. That didn't actually work out. But yeah, I think there are, because Labor, I mean, most political parties, but Labor is made up of different factions. And some of those factions might be a bit more conservative. They talk about right and left factions so he would obviously be more in the right faction. But when you look at his voting record, he's certainly at odds with the more progressive stances of some of the recent Labor Party policies.
Yeah, and despite that, what you just said, he holds and owns his seat by a massive, massive majority. He's very well liked in the electorate. I haven't looked at the current one, but the previous voting record showed, I think he had a 2/3 majority.
Yeah, it was
which
massive.
Which is humongous.
Yeah, it was massive, yeah.
Even in Australia's current state where we do have a lot of independent and smaller party voters, so you might have 4 or 5 or 6 people to vote for, and to have a 2/3 majority over all of those is humongous. Because quite often, you notice a lot of politicians are getting on based on preferences and second choice and that sort of stuff, whereas on his own, he's miles ahead of the rest.
Yeah.
It's almost why bother campaigning? For our point of view, it doesn't matter who we vote for because of how far ahead he is. If I don't like his party, well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, he's going to win anyway.
It's what they call a very, very safe seat.
Yeah. And actually, a couple of years ago when I was living in that, well, more than a couple of years now, but when I was living in that electorate, I emailed him just on a, because I saw that his party had adopted a stance on an issue that I wasn't too happy about. And so I emailed him saying, this is the stance, can you please explain? Because I'm actually really happy with where your party's going with this, which goes to that point one of being political. And he actually emailed me back. So I was kind of surprised. I didn't expect to get a reply. And he was saying, you know, yeah, the party has gone in this direction, but look at my voting record. I resist. I'll always vote against it. If it comes up as a vote in parliament, I would go against my party's vote, or, you know, or against the majority view and have my own view there. So yeah, that's an interesting one with that. So getting involved in politics is one step, one way that Australians can share their faith in this current climate.
Perhaps one thing we both sort of did, although it was more a game, if you like.
Yeah.
We went on to one of the network had a vote on not so much a vote. What do you call it?
Just a vote compass, or
which sort of led us down what, like, it had a question or an issue, and it said, all four of the prime parties. So there's two major ones, and then there was two more outliers. So Liberal and Labor, the two sort of central left, central right, and then two parties on either side of those further out.
So the extreme left and extreme right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And it didn't say whose policy it was, but it said pick the policy you prefer the most.
Yeah.
And it collated all of those together. Probably about 40 questions.
Sort of said, what do you think about this? Yeah, that's right.
And it sort of gave you an impression, well, if you think this about that, it'll be sort of collated together, and gave you an indication of which party, based on your answers, you would be inclined to vote for.
And it was, this was the vote compass that the Australian broadcast,
national ABC.
Broadcast,
yep.
That's right, yeah. So, Jared, I was not happy with this with this website, because I went through the effort to answer all their questions, and in the end, it told me that both the major parties, there was only a 1% difference in my, so it was 50. It was like, I don't know, it was 50-something. Say it was 56, would have been 56 to 57%. So it was basically a dead heat for me.
It wasn't 100% sort of thing.
Yeah,
it was how you answered towards certain things.
Yeah. And the reason for that was because the Liberal Party, being our Conservative Party, had some good policies, but it had some policies that I wasn't comfortable with. Then the Labor Party also had some good social policies, but also had some really bad policies that I definitely couldn't see myself voting for as well. So ended up saying, well, you probably want to vote for both. Thanks. Thank you very much, Vote Compass. Yeah. So the next point he makes after being political is just basically, if I could summarize this paragraph into a sentence, it would be know your faith. So what does the church teach on faith and morals? And I might add to this as well. We recently at my school, we had a priest come in and speak to our religious education staff and any other staff who were interested. And his discussion was about how do you talk about faith and morals in a climate where people aren't really interested in hearing you talk about faith and morals. So he was talking about how to actually hold discussions. So what was it? How do you share your faith without raising your voice, or something along those lines? So the whole idea is talking about faith without getting into a fight. And this was especially aimed, first of all, at teachers talking to students. So you know, I'm a religious education teacher, and in my classes, from time to time, students will bring up moral issues. So it's always like, we never argue in my class. It's rare that students will argue with teachers and grandstand, but you know, we certainly have a dialogue about the different stances. And then students tell me, for example, let's just say, you know, euthanasia is, you know, in Victoria, where, you know, the first euthanasias will happen very, very soon. And so we were talking about it. And so I tell the students, you know, all right, tell me your stance on it. And then I'll challenge their stance. You know, what about this? You know, have you considered that? What about the changing role of doctors from healing to this? And, you know, and so a dialogue, we go back and forth. And then students give me a chance to sort of state my position, and I get them to ask me questions. So I feel like I come out on top, having more, you know, just being the older, more experienced ones. But you know, at least, I can share my faith and, you know, plant seeds of faith there. So what he was talking about was, he says, if you are going to talk about faith and morals in a classroom, there is preparation you can do, and teachers should be prepared anyway. But he says, think about what is being said in the public square, because this is what the students are going to hear. What's actually being said in the public square? You know, the church hates this group of people. You know, the church is restricting our lives here and there. These are the things that you generally hear. And then he says, then think about the students have expressed an opinion. What do they actually value in this opinion? So if we think, for example, say same-sex marriage, right? If students are favoring same-sex marriage, it might be because they value love. It might be because they value compassion. It might be because they value equality. And then he said, well, the next thing is, well, can you see anything in that list of values that the church actually opposes? So we don't oppose love. We don't oppose compassion or equality. We just look at those things in a particular in a particular different way. So then what he says is then you reframe the statement. So if we go from the church hates this group of people, you think about it, you say the church loves all people, but it has a particular view on marriage, or it has a particular view on life, or a particular view on this. And he talks about how that encourages dialogue and openness, rather than saying, no, the church didn't say that, or the church doesn't do that. How dare you say that about the church?
Sounds like childhood bickering.
Exactly. Well, funny enough, that's what some adults, you know, when you look online, that seems to be what they're doing, isn't it? So knowing your stuff and knowing how to talk about it, I guess, is how we'd summarize that point. The third point he makes is speak in the public square. So this doesn't, first of all, mean getting on a soapbox, which is what I do in this podcast sometimes, or becoming a social media junkie. And by the way, I don't recommend trying to get into the public square on, say, Twitter and making statements, because you're likely to, I don't know, it seems to become a pretty toxic place, but that might just be what I've seen. But it does mean, first of all, when occasions present themselves at our barbecue or workplace, then talk with the greatest charity about what God thinks about some of these situations and what some of the challenges and issues are in there. And he says, it's true, this is not easy to do. So, yeah, you know, talking, you know, if we have family who have very different views from us, or in a work, I think Caroline in previous podcasts has talked about how sometimes in a workplace, she'll be the only Catholic person with a Catholic point of view, while there'll be others who'll be like very sort of anti-Catholic and so on. But he says it just requires sometimes a bit of courage to open your mouth, and also wisdom to know when to speak as well. Jared, point number four, have you ever considered a career in journalism?
Wow.
Yeah.
Go to the next one.
Or politics. Yeah. Yeah. But he says, then he clarifies, if you're in a position to do so. And he says that they're noble professions of public service. And if you feel called to those, think about doing them. Now, I do know that there's an apostolate here in Melbourne, and I'm pretty sure that they exist in other parts of the world, called Catholic Voices. Have you heard of them at all before?
I haven't, no.
They're it's basically a person, who was it? There was a journalist in the UK whose name I can't remember. This is the story to it. And he watched a debate between two Catholics. One was a bishop, one was a Catholic politician, and it was the late Christopher Hitchens and Stephen Fry, and they were talking about faith and about, you know, about atheism trumping faith and so on. Now, Christopher Hitchens and Stephen Fry are and were, because one's deceased, very eloquent speakers and very, very intelligent in the way that they craft language. And on the back of the use of language alone, they won. Like they wiped the floor with the Catholic speakers, because the Catholic speakers said things that make sense to people of faith, but not necessarily to anyone else. So this journalist watched this debate and said, well, you know, how frustrating that Catholics can't articulate their faith, you know, properly, and, you know, get the message out so that people can have those misconceptions cleared up, because it seemed like Fry and Hitchens were relying on a lot of misconceptions to, you know, to have a good bash that day. So he started an apostolate called Catholic Voices, and it called Catholic lay people to come and have media training, so that local bishops could direct media inquiries to Catholic Voices, and these Catholic Voices speakers would then, you know, answer questions and clarify things. So that, I have seen people from Catholic Voices sometimes in the media, and they just, you know, they just speak. There's no debates or anything, but they tend to speak about, you know, what's happening. So instead of getting to journalism, that might be a, for example, if there are apostolates where Catholics are trained to speak to the media, that could be another thing as well. And lastly, it says, finally, of course, and this is probably the most important one, it says pray. But he says, how often do we pray for our prime minister, for our opposition leader? If we don't present them to God, what do we expect? Pray every day for our political leaders, especially for those who most annoy us. Pray for our society, that the Lord intervenes and solves our problems. So actually, this is a confronting dot point for me, because Jared, I'm not sure how often I actually pray for our politicians. What about you? Would you care to share how often you pray for ours? Or
pray they get rid of this dirty dog.
Yeah, yeah.
Pray we don't have this person in charge of us. That's probably about the gist. It's sort of
a preventative prayer. Would you call that? Yeah.
Please, Lord, please don't let this person be in charge of our country. Yeah, that sort of would probably be more what you'd you know, you'd think would be when you think of praying for politicians.
Yeah.
That's probably not quite the right way to go. I mean, if you've got a problem with someone, praying for them and for that problem you have with them to at least be resolved in one way or another, whether it's one or the other coming to a realization of that not being correct, or, you know, how that such a thing could coexist.
Yeah.
Because people who are deep set in your ways, and what, like you might be saying, there's a reason why they've got that point of view. And it might not be because they hate Catholics, but it might be some other life experience that they've had has led them to believe this is the right way of going about things, whether or not we believe that's correct. And that might be why such a thing has happened. Possibly coming back to the politician we covered early on in our podcast. I've forgotten his name now, but he was...
Bill Hayden?
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah, yeah.
Being, you know, not being a Catholic until later on because of the people who prayed for him.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, he spent his whole political career as an atheist.
With people praying for him all the way through.
Was a potential runner for prime minister at one stage or a leader of the Labour Party. Yeah, that's right. And yet, you know, there, he instituted a lot of good things and ended up becoming Catholic one day too. See, so our current prime minister, Scott Morrison, is a Christian. And Bill Shorten, who was the opposition leader who was running for prime minister, is an Anglican. So now, whatever we think about their particular politics, the thing is they were actually both men of faith.
Well, the current Labour one who took over, Anthony Albanese, is a lapsed Catholic.
There you go. Yeah. So there's hope yet. So, I mean, we can pray, I guess, that that their eyes are opened to their faith, you know, to what that they have true and authentic experiences of their faith, things like that, so that their policies can be better thought out, and they have courage to speak to their political parties about things like that. And for those who might not have any faith or might be lapsed, that we'll just pray, I guess, that they see the light. It does happen. So there we go. Why don't we move on? And I'll throw this one over to you, just sticking with our Faith Beyond Borders. We've got two other stories to share. They're both shorter ones. But, Jared, you found a story about, and I think this is fantastic, Australia's first Torres Strait Islander priest. You give us a rundown of that.
Yep. All right. Now, found this one. This is similar to the episode we sort of covered where there was an Aboriginal Deacon Boniface, I think it was.
Yes.
So Torres Strait Islanders are, again, they're original Indigenous Australians. They're sort of separate based on geographic, and it's a slightly, you know, it's a different culture as well. So Torres Strait Island are islands that are slightly north of the Queensland area, which is northeast. Never eat soggy wee bits. Yeah, northeast part of Australia between Australia and Papua New Guinea.
I have to jump in and clarify. So I'm sure people know, actually, I don't know what other people use around the world, but never eat soggy Weet-Bix is how you know where north, south, east, and west are. And Weet-Bix being a very important breakfast, you know, staple breakfast diet here in Australia. Go on, Jerry.
Yep. All right. So now in St. Francis Xavier Church in Cairns, which is in North Queensland, 55-year-old, I hope I say this right, Father Kapel Gibuma, was ordained into the Catholic priesthood and to minister to the ordinariate of Our Lady of the Southern Cross. And you'll get to that bit later.
Sure.
I've struggled with trying to come figure out how those sort of things work. Now, he's the first Torres Strait Islander to be ordained a Catholic deacon and Catholic priest. And the Monsignor who was part of it, he said it's a historic moment which he could encourage more Indigenous men to become priests in the future. We hope this will be the beginning of more Indigenous brothers and sisters to explore vocations to the religious life. Now, we've talked in our podcast before about the closeness that the Catholic Church and the Aboriginal and Indigenous community have.
Yes,
based on, you know, how their belief in the dream time and how that sort of collaborates with our Catholic faith. The Monsignor, he's got even a harder name, Monsignor Entwistle,
yes.
It looks like, said it's been a joyous weekend for the parish, and the confirmation and the ordination services were flavoured with Torres Strait Islander and missionary hymns and traditional dances. So similar to perhaps some of the other Pacific Islanders, they've got their own culture and dances and things that are used to, I suppose, they would spice up. Definitely spice up a Catholic service.
Yeah, and they've always tried to integrate liturgy into the local cultures. So rather than turning local cultures into Western civilizations, they insert mass and liturgy and everything into what the local culture does. Anything else you want to add there, Jerry?
I believe his mission is going to continue within that area of Australia, so that Torres Strait Islanders and the Northern Queenslanders again. I had a look, and I haven't. No way, I'm going to be able to bring that page up again. I had a look at the Torres Strait Islander population, sort of percentage-wise in Australia, and it's very concentrated up in the north areas of Queensland. So he's going to continue to minister to those sort of people, his people, in that area.
Yeah. So the just to add a footnote to that story, we were talking about the personal ordinariate of Our Lady of the Southern Cross. So basically, this is a ministry. So we understand that these ordinariates also exist in the UK and the United States as well. And I think we worked out that Australia was possibly the third country to have one of these as well. Pope Benedict XVI introduced these ordinariates, and it was a place through which people who have Anglican heritage can be received fully into the Catholic Church. So that tells me that that it's possible that he was Anglican before being Catholic, and he's worked his way through the process of that. That's what I'm going to guess.
Articles doesn't go too deeply into that.
It actually doesn't clarify.
It
yes,
more yeah. focuses on the on what he is now, which is good. Yeah.
All right, and so let's move on, and let me quote a famous black duck that we used to watch when we were little. Anyone for tennis? Yeah, that's usually followed by Elmer Fudd's rifles.
Shotgun blast. Nice game.
Yeah. So, Jared, priests find a new way to serve is the headline. Why don't you
tell us?
Headline. Yeah, I love it. It's great. The other one I think I saw was priests causing a racket. So why don't you tell us what's going on in this story?
All right. So this podcast is going to be released, I believe, in the middle of June. A couple of weeks after that, in Lincoln, Nebraska, is going to be the probably 8th International Tennis Championship for priests. So a global competition. So French Open's on right now as we're recording. That's going to be done and dusted by then. So
An Australian woman into the grand final.
Oh, she made it through.
Through, yes, absolutely. So hoping that she's going to win that.
Very good.
But I digress.
So, yes, priests find a new way to serve. So the article from Cat News talks about, so there's a Father Brian Connor, who's the local, I believe he's the local priest, or a local priest from that diocese of Lincoln in Nebraska, central northern America. So he said there's, at the moment, he's got 46 priests who are registered to play. From Poland, Philippines, Slovakia, Canada, Argentina, Indonesia, and of course the United States. I'm hoping Australia will find someone.
We need an Aussie priest in there. Yeah, we've got to train someone up.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're not eligible to compete.
No.
But so they've been doing this for a while now. Now, it had its origins in Poland as a local table tennis competition. And that morphed into, I suppose, a sort of a national tennis competition within Poland. And then
And you and I can relate to local table tennis competitions.
Most certainly. And in 2012, they took a step to open it up to the world. So the current organizer, I've got his name here, is Father Brian O'Connor. I believe he actually won the tournament in 2014.
Yep, correct.
After playing a couple of years before that. And so this year, I think it's been in Poland. So it originated in Poland, then they took it to the Philippines and to Italy. And I think this is the first year they're having it in the United States.
And can I just say, by the way, that all the priests need to do is to be able to afford to fly over. And then it says everything else is covered. So they'll put the priests up with, somewhere to stay. They'll feed them, transport them, whatever else. All they need to do to be able is to fly to wherever the competition is. So they don't have to spend thousands and thousands on accommodation and on make sure they've got food to eat and organizing tours and whatever else. There's a lot of priestly fraternity going on here. So someone is the host and they put them up somewhere and they look after all their needs and have a good game of tennis.
Yeah. So local donors have pitched in to help out and make sure that's the case. Reason for that is Father Brian Connor, who I'd mentioned he's been to at least three. The first one in 2012, and then in 2013, it says he won in 2014. Because of his experiences, where he basically went there and they did everything for him, he wanted to make sure that the same service was offered back when he was host, or now that he is host. Now it's the 3-day comp is held 28th to the 30th of June. And although I think it's almost a week long, probably similar to World Youth Day.
It is a week long, yes.
Yeah, where you've got all the events beforehand and things to do, like walk, sightseeing and things to do. And then the competition proper is held over the last 3 days of June.
Yeah. What I love is that there's a lot of tennis to play. So it's not like you lose and you're out forever. They've also got a secondary competition, consolation.
They call it a consolation.
Yeah, consolation competition. Yeah. So if you lose, there are doubles and singles, tournaments. So basically, I mean, they're going there to play tennis. They're not going to play one match. So they've got more tennis to play as well, and to make it competitive. It looks like the itinerary is up on their website too, which is great, but the whole itinerary it's basically dinner, mass, tennis, sightseeing, dinner, mass, tennis, so there's a lot of that going on. But it looks like, attention to their spirituality. So this is about priestly fraternity, which I love hearing about when priests support each other. So it's, I saw prayers in their local cathedral and masses and things like that. So, sounds like it'd be a spiritually uplifting, but also a spirits uplifting kind of activity as well. So I reckon we want to add another point.
Well, I was going to say Nebraska's sort of central to the SQPN priests.
Ah,
so I think by the time this podcast comes out, there will still be time to register.
Yeah.
Father Corey.
Yeah, get your tennis shoes on.
Actually, I think Father Andrew is the closest.
Ah, right.
Because he's in, I think he's in Wyoming.
Yeah.
I think that's the state next door. That's not saying much because they're big states in the middle.
Can I say I'm impressed by your geography, knowledge of the United States, because I don't have much of that knowledge at all. It's Father Andrew, who's on Secrets of Technology. Yes. So, yes, fantastic.
I think he's in the state next door, but I think that's still comparable to a 6 or 7 hour journey.
You can hop in the car. I'm just thinking, if anyone is in the Diocese of Lincoln and they do see this, we'd love to hear, I don't know if it's open to the public. Have they got a crowd to watch?
Yeah, would be.
I'm sure they have. Yeah, people would go there for a bit of a laugh as well and a bit of fun. If anyone goes or witnesses this, or if there are any priests who listen to SQPN who have participated, we'd love to know how this went and hear more about it, because I reckon it's a fantastic thing. And it turns out in this article too, it talks about how this is not the only competition. There are other competitions that other priests organize. So I've seen here in the list softball, basketball. I'm not sure. I'm sure there are others too. But I've never heard of a priestly AFL, Australian rules footy, or a rugby one. Yeah, I'm not sure if that's a thing.
Yeah, I don't think it will be a thing, because you want your priest to go home at the end without, torn anterior cruciate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
So for me,
busted ACLs.
Tennis is probably actually one of the best ones for it, because first of all, to play tennis, you need to use everything.
Yes.
Arms, balance, legs, movement, as well as
prayer.
Thinking. in terms of the physical body.
Yes.
So I think in one of the other articles we looked at when preparing for this, one of the priests said, tennis is not really what you associate with priesthood. When you think of priests, you think of golf.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
One of the priests sort of saying that. So, yeah. And as well as that, there's the non-contact part of it, which means the only injuries you're likely to sustain are, self-inflicted ones.
Well, can I say, I mean, the worst, because I used to play, I played tennis for about 5 or 6 years, firstly when I was in high school and then up until, I don't know, when I was my early 20s, I sort of stopped around then. The worst injury I ever received was when I was playing doubles and my partner served the ball into the back of my head. Yeah. And that it hurt physically, and he hurt my pride as well, because he started laughing after that too. So thanks, partner. we got anything else to talk about on this? Or?
Well, just quickly as well, it dovetails onto Pope Francis. Recently, there was an Italian soccer competition. Just in the it seems like a local sort of youth one in Italy, and he spoke to the participants beforehand. Now, while he didn't specifically talk about tennis and focus more on the team sport, he spoke on the merits of sport in strengthening both your bodies and strengthening of the souls. And he encouraged, encouraged people to get out and find something you can get involved in rather than isolating yourself, especially on social media. So he had a bit of a jab at the, people who stay at home and on, behind a screen, as opposed to getting out and being physically active.
Yeah. That's good. And he's spoken over the years about the value of sports in many different ways. So he's also spoken to sporting teams. He's had soccer teams, visit, and then, they give him shirts and whatever else. But he's talked about their leadership as well and how they can be faith leaders. There are a lot of soccer players who are Catholic or Christian who tend to, we see a lot of players make signs of the cross. We've seen teams gather and do prayer circles at the start and end of matches. So there's a powerful witness in sports as well. Sports has, people can be obsessed with sport in the wrong kind of way, but there's actually also a beautiful spiritual dimension to sport that we can also appreciate as well. There's evangelizing power there.
Yeah, well, Pope Francis does touch on that when he talks to the to these people as well. He says they call soccer the beautiful game, but in terms of what sometimes happens, it stops being a game and starts being either a power grab or it starts getting aggressive. And he also has a shot at the so-called sporting parents who get more involved in the game than the children do. And he said that everything you say to them and tell them when they're playing and after they've played their matches, it'll stay with them and it'll help shape them when they grow.
Absolutely.
So not slap on the wrist or maybe a tap on the back of the head.
Just a reminder. Yeah. Gentle reminder.
Think about what you're doing. And I suppose that's potentially a bit pertinent for us as our children start entering that age where they could be choosing to do the same thing. At stages, Damien has played soccer in the past before. At the moment, Caitlin's quite happy doing gymnastics.
Yeah.
But as they get older and they may start getting more involved in team sports, growing up, you played tennis, but our family all had basketball and I had soccer, all sorts of things for them to get involved in and, potentially something for us to be aware of.
Yeah. You've got your table tennis now. That's, I used to go to that and unfortunately just too busy with nights these, at the state, at
funny,
this stage.
Funny but... enough, where you work.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's at my workplace.
So when
you
are too busy at work.
Yeah. If I stayed back for a couple of hours, I could join you. Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Very good. So that probably about wraps that, wraps those up.
Yeah, so why don't we take a risk and talk about science?
Ah, what a fine day for science.
You have any hobbies?
I collect spores, molds, and fungus.
Can you reverse the polarity?
I'll do my best.
So, Jared, I found this article from Alatea, and I think it was on Crux and a few other different websites as well. And it's a safe one, so we're not going to be tackling with any difficult scientific concepts here. In fact, we're probably talking about a person more than we are talking about a scientific concept. So the headline is Jesuit Astronomer Traces Stellar History Through Galactic Halos. And this is an article about a Jesuit priest, Father Richard de Souza. Now, just looking at the description here, I think he has a doctoral degree. Is that what you call it? Yes, you do.
Wait, postdoctoral researcher.
Okay, well, we'll go. There you go. And he researches at the University of Michigan, and he says mass they've got a local church somewhere at that university where he says mass as well. So what's really amazing is that Father de Souza, we've talked before about Brother Guy Consolmagno a lot because he's, he puts out all this fascinating space astronomy stuff. But it's, he's another priest who's fascinated by space. Now, here's the technical part. And I'm not going to get too technical here, but he has been studying the halos of galaxies. So it turns out that there are galactic halos. So like there's
hopefully Dom can put a sound effect in there when you say that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no pressure, Dom. But basically, each galaxy has its own galactic halo, and in particular, spiral-shaped galaxies. Sorry, I was thinking about Discworld, which is another Terry Pratchett novel. But anyway, it's a spiral-shaped galaxies all have their own halo, and apparently they provide clues to the formation of galaxies over their multi-billion-year history. So the key thing is this. Studying the halo, I think, of the Andromeda Galaxy, he theorized that the Andromeda Galaxy actually formed by absorbing other galaxies over the course of billions of years as well. And he did this by looking at how, where is it? It says here, the clues of this came from the stars in the Andromeda Galaxy that had a higher proportion of metallicity elements, heavier than hydrogen and helium. These proportions match the chemical compositions of stars in the remnants of the Andromeda Galaxy of other parts as well. So essentially, there are things in the Andromeda Galaxy that are different to, you know, was it Sesame Street? One of these things is not like the other. So there, one of these stars is not like the others, or millions of these stars are not like others. Let me drop that joke very quickly. But basically,
you got that in my head.
Yeah,
thanks.
Sorry about that. Yeah. But yeah, so basically, he and another professor whose name is
Eric Bell.
Eric Bell, thank you. Yep. They put a paper together and shared this with scientific circles. So basically, this paper that they produced. Apparently has mixed reactions because there were different scientists who said, well, this is really amazing, and others said this is really iffy. But the thing is, what's happening is that as Father D'Souza is running around talking about it, there are others, there are people who are getting very, very excited about this theory that he's come up with. So the other thing is he does have a link with Brother Guy Consolmagno, because what's happening now is Father D'Souza, it says here, Brother Consolmagno says, that Father D'Souza is well established enough in research that he could do research anywhere now. So he's got a rep that's big enough that he could do research at any university on, you know, on the science of space. But actually what's happening is Father D'Souza is excited because he is going to start working with Brother Guy at the Vatican Observatory, which apparently is something he's wanted to do for a very, very long time. So the last point I'll make very quickly is that Father D'Souza likens his scientific work to the understanding of meaning in life. So he sees the search, the call to search for meaning and understanding of God's creation. He says there's no conflict between science and Catholic faith, something that we've, you know, harped on about quite a lot. And he says, we're looking for something beyond us. The most transcendental thing you could have is God. Astronomy is the most transcendental of the sciences and yet most physical. And that is the reason, perhaps, it has long fascinated everyone in history. So, studying the science of space, it's one of the highest things you could do, literally. but also the idea that this is so big and we're so small, and you know, it's very similar to the idea that God is so big in the sense of being a creator, and we're the creator. This was something we talked about in a previous episode. There's that sense of wonder that comes from that as well. Do you have any thoughts on Father D'Souza, Jerry?
Well, I had a quick look through that article as well. Now, that Andromeda Galaxy, I believe that's actually our neighbour. So, not a good neighbour to have by the sounds of it.
No, it's very greedy. And I think, from memory, there was a scientist who said that the Milky Way Galaxy and the Andromeda Galaxy are on a collision course.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, take a couple of billion years
for our that many descendants.
Yeah. You know, look, humans will have ascended to another plane by then, so we'll never, yeah.
Or just moved on to another galaxy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we'll
just not, M87.
Yeah, the United Federation of Planets will be a thing of the past. Yeah, nowhere near that, yes. Yeah, but that's that's billions of years away. So it's Andromeda is it's keeping up its reputation of gobbling up other galaxies. And what else are we going to add there?
Now, just having a look at the dates in the article, now he's been at the University of Michigan for 3 years, and the article also talks about, he's been there since 2016 and he's got a 3-year tenure there. So that means now that we're in 2019, it should be potentially imminent that he's going to be part of the Vatican Observatory. So I'm wondering if it's quite possible in a future episode when we have a brother guy, I can't say his name,
Consolmagno,
we might also be saying an article or a paper by Dr. Richard D'Souza.
Father D'Souza, yeah.
Yeah, Father D'Souza.
Now, can I suggest before Father D'Souza makes his way over to Rome, he might want to swing by Illinois and have a bit of a game of tennis with his brother priest before he heads off.
Yeah. What's he going to do in Illinois?
Yeah, isn't that where it is? Diocese of
Nebraska. Lincoln.
Oh, whoops. Okay, I'm sorry, America. I'm in the South Pole. All right? I can't see from here. All right,
Southern Hemisphere.
Southern.
Oh gosh.
Oh my gosh.
Don't try geology.
No. Don't. You know what? Anything.
That was a joke. It's geometry.
Yeah. Oh.
Sorry, we better move on before we get completely lost.
I just wanted to finish
literally
this
and figuratively, but yes,
in all kinds of ways, transcendentally. But we just wanted to congratulate Father D'Souza on getting to the Vatican Observatory, and like you said, we can't wait to see what work he produces. So why don't we very, very quickly move away from the science segment? And actually, we just wanted to finish off this podcast with a bit of follow up. So, Jared, you and I, a couple of podcasts ago, we talked about Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And we focused on the fire and we got excited because we didn't realize that there was a beekeeper. Was it Our Lady's Bees? I think it was the, yeah. So did you follow in the recent weeks or in the weeks following that story, the competition that that Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, proposed in order to restore the cathedral within 5 years?
Now, opening these things to the public is always fraught with danger.
Absolutely.
Anyone who remembers Bodie McBoatface? And then there was
I'm going to start laughing now. Yes.
And then there was another competition, which I can't remember what it was, but again, a naming competition. So fortunately, the French president hasn't opened up the name of Notre Dame to the
cathedral and cathedral face. Yeah, that's
fortunately. Yeah. But opening up designs, and then again, that's still fraught with danger because then you get all the wild and wacky people coming out of the woodwork with their grand ideas.
Yeah. So in this case, the restoration of the roof and spire was put out to the public as a competition, and a whole lot of people, you know, well known. Architects, I'm assuming in the architect world because I have no idea. I'm from the South Pole, as we worked out recently in the previous segment. But obviously, you know, being architects who are influenced by clearly by modern art, there were some of the top designs or proposals were publicized, and we got to take a look at them. And I think it would be fair to say that we looked at them with a bit of horror. Would that be a fair statement to say, Jerry?
A bit, probably understating, but yes.
Yeah. What could you say that's worse? But blinding terror. Yeah. But why don't you tell us what stood out of the five or six that we saw, what stood out to you as very, very interesting in terms of some of these proposals?
All right. So practically here, after a place that's been, you know, had a fire, we've got an option of a pool on the roof.
Yeah. Okay. So that was one that was probably the one I was thinking about.
Yep. So, you know, what do we have an issue with? The fire burning up the place. So therefore, pool on the roof, we're not going to have any fire problems anymore.
Yeah.
You know, potentially full immersion baptisms available.
Oh, gosh. Wow. Yes. yes. And just in time for the Olympics. So, I mean, they could have, you know, some swimming races there.
Of course.
So, yeah. So clearly, and this was a legitimately proposed idea to, if not to have a full length swimming pool, but to have hotel rooms up there with
penthouse views,
penthouse views and a swimming pool included as well.
Now, can I just ask, when you were in Paris,
yes,
what was the parking like? Or you may not have had a car, but what is the traffic like?
The traffic was not awesome. It was it was pretty rough in certain places where it's very busy. It wasn't good, and actually Notre Dame Cathedral is on an island with a bridge leading to it, so I wouldn't say driving there was going to be very good if we're talking about lots of people going there.
So now people need somewhere to put their cars.
Yeah.
Why not put them on the roof?
Because that was another one. So what did you see there, Jerry?
A parking lot on the roof of Notre Dame.
Awful? That's just...
Now, I'm not sure if that one went beyond... Because, see, some of them were made in all seriousness, like potentially the hotel and, you know, different coloured roofing. Stained glass, I think, was another word. They're serious.
That was a serious one, having a whole stained glass roof. Most of the designs were glass-based,
looking like a Christmas present.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But I think this one was a bit more tongue-in-cheek and not really serious design. Still, if you ever got to Mass and you had trouble, you wouldn't have trouble, you know, when
parking,
we going to park.
At least, yeah, that's right, on top of the cathedral. Yeah, that's awful. I'm horrified by that one. There was another one that was legitimately proposed, and that was to have a greenhouse with, you know, with a garden, you know, trees, plants, and then a big glass spire, you know, pointing to heaven. That was another one that was proposed. And there was another one, the beacon, the light, did you see that one? It was another glass one with a light that shoots straight into the night sky to call aliens to Earth or something. I'm not sure. It's not a smart idea. But where are we going with this? Thankfully.
Nowhere. Nowhere.
Well, yeah, nowhere fast, which is actually really good to say because thankfully the French Senate recently voted that the design of the cathedral will be as it last looked before the fire, which means basically restore it to the way it was. And that gives me a lot of hope because I actually was concerned because clearly when you open it to the world, it looked to me like the legitimate yet strange designs that people were coming up with were very secular. So for me, you know, the spire and the whole point of the height of a cathedral is actually to point our eyes towards God. But really creating a spectacle, it was like, look, look, look here. You know, it's like that look at me kind of thing. So the spectacle became more of a priority than the faith aspect. This is a place of prayer. it became, you know, really ramping up this as a tourist destination.
And it doesn't need any help in that regard anyway. It's Notre Dame. It doesn't need to attract tourists.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't need to advertise for tourists.
Believe me, when I was there, you know, even in the middle of the week, there were lots of tourists going to Notre Dame. And actually, just as an aside, so what would happen is, and I've saw this in other cathedrals in some of the other countries we visited, people would be directed to walk around the side, you know, if there were tourists. But if you were there to pray, you got special access to the middle. And so when I worked this out, I said, well, as my family, well, let's go pray. Why not? When you go to pray and you're in the middle, I reckon you get the best view of the interior of the cathedral too, which is kind of awesome. And you can just take a few sneaky photos too after praying, clearly. Yeah. So anyway, I wanted to round up this story by saying, thankfully, Notre Dame, if they manage to stick to the 5-year timeline that they're talking about, will be restored to what it was before. Anything else you wanted to add to that, or we can close that one off?
We can close that off with, well, that's a minimal news is good news in respect of what the French Parliament have come back with.
Yeah, it's politicians doing the right thing, which is good to see. So
someone's been praying for them.
Yeah, very hard, obviously. Yes, that's right. Yeah. They read that article. So we wanted to thank everyone for joining us for episode 11 of Catholics of Oz. And before we go, we'd like to take a moment to thank the patrons who make it possible for us to create the Catholics of Oz and also the other content on SQPM. Today we want to thank Chris M., Robert W., Stephen G., Matt T., and Dennis W. Through their generous donations at sqpn.com/give, they make it possible for the Catholics of Oz and all of our other shows at StarQuest to continue. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. Also, we'd like to know your thoughts about today's episode. What did you think about the topics that we were talking about? We had to stop ourselves before getting a bit too ridiculous with Notre Dame. But however, you can send us your own feedback, even just send a sigh of relief emoji if there is one, by visiting sqpn.com/oz, and you can find our show notes there as well. You can also find us on Facebook. The Facebook page is facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. And we also have our own Facebook page, which we'd love for you to join and to see what we're doing there. And that's at facebook.com/TheCatholicsOfOz, where you can join us in discussing our latest episodes. Also, you can reach us by email at catholicsofoz@sqpn.com. Jerry, thanks very much for being on the show today.
Pleasure to have been here.
And once again, I'm Lindsay Sand, and thank you for listening to The Catholics of Oz.